Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand. And donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Last week, I told you about this landmark precedent-setting libel ruling against Kevin J. Johnston. Johnston is one of these Faith Goldie online right-wing racist assholes. He has a much, much smaller following, and we've covered him a little bit on the website before, but admittedly, I was not that familiar with his works until this case. This case is kind of what's putting him on the map. This is a $2.5 million decision against Johnston. It is rare in Canada for a libel ruling to break the $1 million mark. Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. This is what Kevin Johnston sounds like.
We would like to make sure that all of you know that October is Islamic Heritage Month so that we can honor all the great contributions made by Muslims around Ontario. Stop. Name one.
When you finally die and get to meet the Salah guy, he's going to lie to you and trick you and take everything. You're going to deal with an omnipotent psychopath who's going to put anything he wants in your anus.
How much money does he take from the Pakistani spy agency? Is he part of an Islamic front? Oh, here we go. The libel notice. Immediately publish an unequivocal apology and retraction. I believe in my heart of hearts that this guy absolutely is taking money from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. I believe that. How do you make such good falafel? And he'll say, well, you take dough and put a grenade in it and blow it up in the oven and it tastes great. You see, that right there, that's called satire. Muhammad Faqih can go straight to hell.
Kevin J. Johnston tells us that the J in Kevin J. Johnston is for jackal. The J is for jackass, according to the court. The ruling was unambiguous in its complete condemnation of this guy. He didn't do a very good job of defending himself. He didn't even hire a lawyer. He hired a paralegal who missed a court appearance because he was stuck in traffic. Johnston did not file any materials to the court to help his case. Apparently, he made some sort of feeble defense that satire is the defense as to why he was able to say these things. What sort of things did he say? Well, it's all the hits. It's the worst stuff. He called Canadian Muslims terrorists, terrorist scumbags, racist terrorist scumbags. Rapists are in Canada, quote, to take this country over, to kill me and kill my children and kill the entire future of this entire nation, end quote. He has also publicly encouraged people to buy guns, learn how to fight, buy knives and learn how to use them, stock up on crossbow bolts, stock up on arrows for your bow. Stock up on everything you need because, believe me, it's gonna hit the fan, referring to when Muslims bring Sharia law to Canada. And when it does, it's gonna hit hard. You have to hit back three times harder. Okay, so this is like if you were trying to break Canada's hate speech laws, which are actually quite technical. It's very easy for racists to insinuate around them and to suggest that we need to do something against those people without actually naming those people and saying, let's go and shoot them. Johnston went there, but this was not a hate speech case. He's got one of those too, pending. This was a defamation case, a libel case. And you can't be sued for libel for libeling a religion or for a identifiable group. You've got to libel a person. And when it comes to targeting new Canadians, you can usually get away with libeling them. Because, like, what are they going to do? These are members of society who are least likely to hire a lawyer and come after you through the courts, through libel courts. Very expensive and time-consuming and stressful. I mean, to get sued like that, you would have to specifically target that one in a million immigrant who came to Canada, built a fortune, earned a reputation worth protecting, and has a sense of justice and civic consciousness that exceeds their desire to just be left the hell alone. And Kevin J. Johnston did that. He did exactly that. He went after Mohamed Faqih. And Mohamed Faqih is a new Canadian who came here, basically a war refugee from Lebanon, who built the Paramount Fine Foods, the Middle Eastern fast food chain, after starting out working at a Coffee Time. Full disclosure, I like their matabul. Johnston targeted Faqih. He harassed him and his kids. He made absurd allegations that Faqih was funding terrorism. And Faqih stood up to Kevin J. Johnston, and he won. He won a lot. As I said, $2.5 million. This case was airtight. But the ruling made it clear that this was not just about this case. I want to read to you from Justice Ferguson's ruling here. Quote, "Left unchallenged, hate speech poisons the integrity of our democracy. This is not an isolated example," writes Justice Ferguson. "Instead, it reflects an overall rise of hate speech in Canada. According to Statistics Canada, the number of hate crimes reported to the police in 2017, the last year for which data was collected, reached an all-time high. Buried in these statistics are the stories of actual people. We know some of their names, and they are included in this judgment. The victims of these incidents deserve our respect and empathy, as the perpetrators warrant our condemnation and rebuke. In so doing, as this judgment suggests, hateful speech always needs to be identified and confronted when warranted." That's what the justice wrote in her ruling, but of course, hateful speech is usually not identified, confronted. And this was the exception. Guys, it is clear that the court was explicitly making an example of Kevin J. Johnston. And that is a big deal. This concerns the stuff we talk about on the show all the time. Do facts still matter? Can you just say anything? When you don't care about ethical limits, when you don't care about social conventions that say that racism isn't great, when you interpret your freedom of expression as a license to say the worst things possible, when you are not bound by decency or truth or any of the usual stuff that civil society is based on, then what are the limits to online speech? Well, the state just enforced them. Will that stick? Could this inhibit or punish other speech that is less overtly disgusting and dangerous? Could this chill speech that we want in our public discourse? Will this actually help to make the conversation online as we move into a terrifyingly divisive election? Will this make that less toxic? Today's show is about finding out. One more disclosure before we begin, this time from Canada Land's producer, Kasia Mihailovic.
Hi, Jesse. Full disclosure, my boyfriend is a lawyer who works for the firm that represented Mohamed Faqih, but he didn't work on that specific case at all.
Okay, I am going to talk today with libel lawyer Justin Safayeni about what this means from a legal perspective, and I am going to talk with journalist and human rights advocate Amira Al-Gawabi about what this means for media and for Canadian public discourse. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Jason Voorhees, Andrew Ipp, Kellyanne Gibson, Paul Anderson, David Shoot, Gunn Koleoglu, Nick Jordan, and Miguel Borges.
Hi, I'm Miguel Borges in Fort McMurray, Alberta. I've supported Canada Land from the beginning because I think it's important to have independent Canadian media criticism, especially in these crazy times. I especially like Shortcuts. I'm also happy to support Canada Land financially so that others can listen for free.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada, and we talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses. But we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option.
CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter-like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Jesse.
I generally love this ruling, but there's one part that stuck out to me. Mr. Johnston is a self-styled journalist and the owner of freedomreport.ca. He also owns and operates numerous YouTube channels, Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts, and other social media accounts and websites. I have a bone to pick with that. It felt like there was a bit of a passive-aggressive swipe at him for being a self-styled journalist. Like, is his illegitimacy as a journalist because of the fact that he calls himself a journalist and operates online, or is it because he doesn't do journalism? And is that anything that the court should be taking a position on one way or the other?
I gather that the judge didn't give a great deal of thought to that description. I mean, what are you going to call this guy in a set of publicly available reasons? He probably styles himself as a journalist. And so in making that description, court may have had regard to how kind of he characterizes himself. For the purposes of the ruling, I don't see that it makes any difference one way or another, frankly, whether he calls himself a journalist or whether we characterize him differently.
In the Globe coverage of this, they say that he relied on a defense that he was being satirical. Is he arguing that he was a journalist? Because he didn't use the responsible communications defense, which is the journalist's defense. I was practicing journalism when I made these supposedly libelous comments. So was he saying, I'm a joker, I'm like a Stephen Colbert type or something? Or is he saying, I'm a journalist?
It's interesting. The judge kind of tries to tease out what the arguments that Mr. Johnston raises really were. And it's not an easy job to do because, first of all, he doesn't file any material.
Yeah.
So the judge doesn't really have a set of written arguments before. And it's not really clear whether or to what extent they participated and showed up at the hearing itself. So
there's a reference to them missing certain court appearances.
Certainly certain court appearances they missed. Him and the paralegal that seems to have been representing him for part of this.
Evading being served by court documents, like taking swipes at the judge in his videos.
Not a winning strategy.
Yeah.
To your point, yeah, he does raise the satire type defense, which the judge refers to. But of course, that's not a defense to defamation.
Yeah.
You refer to the responsible journalism defense. It seems that he may have briefly raised that as well, but not really pursued it in any meaningful way. And then he raises other defenses that don't really apply. The judge says that he kind of relies on freedom of expression rights in the charter, but you know the charter is between people and the state. It's
yeah.
not between people and other people in the civil courts. So in short, it doesn't look like he put up much of a kind of legally recognizable defense at all.
Well, this was incompetent, right? I mean, it seems like he was much more concerned with grandstanding about his persecution on his YouTube channel than he was in actually like fighting his supposed persecution.
I think that's right. And that's one of many things that makes this case such an outlier is you have somebody who appears to be content, not really to pour effort into defending the defamatory statements after being sued in defamation, but rather continue a campaign of making similar defamatory statements, antagonizing the court, and then not really showing up to defend the lawsuit in any meaningful way.
So if we can
classify this as an outlier. Is it a relevant case? It struck me as like, wow, this is a big deal case. Like, we've been wrestling with this problem of online speech, specifically online hate speech. This is like the biggest, highest profile, certainly in terms of the damages. This seems like a major milestone, precedent-setting case. But then I could also see you saying, yeah, you've got somebody like Faith Goldie. She hires Clayton Ruby. You know, she is aware of the roles she's playing in, and she's being strategic and clever about how to dance around them. Whereas this guy just seems, you know, I don't know if he's right.
There are some important takeaways from the case, but I think we also have to kind of be careful not to blow it up into kind of the new standard for online hate speech. It's very unlikely that the next quote-unquote hate speech case is going to get an award of damages anything close to what happened in this case. But there are some important takeaways. First of all, as you said, that the judge and the court really has some strong and I think insightful language in the decision about the dangers of online hate speech. And I think that's something that we could probably expect other courts to pick up on in the future in terms of being more sensitive to the potential impacts and the need to provide effective remedies. You're correct that this is a precedent-setting case in terms of the amount of damages that were awarded, $2.5 million. As you know, generally damages in defamation cases are quite small. And when I say quite small, I mean $25,000, $50,000, maybe $100,000. But when looking at that $2.5 million in damages, there are a few things that go into that number that aren't going to be present in every case. First of all, the plaintiffs here, they're operating a business. Mm-hmm. And the judge makes a finding that the plaintiffs were in the middle of trying to conclude a business deal to kind of expand the Paramount restaurant franchise overseas when some of these statements came to the attention of the potential business partners and the deal fell apart.
Can I ask you about that? The way that Faqih argues it and his counsel argues it is that he was about to ink a deal in the United Arab Emirates. It was going to bring in an immediate sum, plus it was going to bring in like every year, probably worth a couple million dollars a year is how they describe it. I don't know much about how these things work, but the judge just accepts, you know, he says like, as soon as this business partner Googled me and saw that Johnston had associated me with terrorism and made all these allegations and said these terrible things, well, the deal didn't go any further past that. And then the judge says, okay, we're going to award something in the tune of $2 million just for that. Right. Now, if Johnston had actually defended himself, would he not have said, wait a second, can you prove that that's why the deal didn't go forward?
No, that's a good point. And, you know, from reading the reasons, we don't know exactly all of the evidence that the plaintiffs put forward on that issue. We get a kind of very brief summary of it from the judge. So we don't know exactly how detailed the evidence was connecting what was said by Mr. Johnson to the deal eventually falling apart. But certainly I would have thought that if the defendants in this case had a lawyer and kind of genuinely participated in the process, that that would be an issue that would be at least worthy of careful cross-examination and mm-hmm. trying to test the causal link between the statements made and this deal falling apart.
Is this just the de facto thing that's going to happen when the defendant doesn't defend themselves? Or is the judge basically, okay, I'm going to throw the book at you and make an example out of you, and the plaintiff has given me a sum, so let's go with that.
Well, in this case, the other thing that happened, of course, is that Mr. Johnson made statements after the deal fell through, kind of almost taking credit for it and saying that, you know, if he was happy that if he had caused this, that was something that he could live with. And he was quite satisfied with that result. So,
yeah,
it was again, I think it's a bit of a perfect storm in many ways between, you know, a very sympathetic plaintiff, a very unsympathetic defendant who doesn't engage in the process. And there must have been at least some evidentiary basis before the judge to make this finding, but certainly wasn't tested the same way it would be if the defendant had a lawyer.
It seems like there's just such a, you know, a lack of understanding that this isn't a video game. This is real.
Who knows what his motives are? I mean, the other possibility, of course, is that he knows very well what he's doing and he's kind of content to keep pushing this on his various platforms to gain further support and notoriety in those communities.
Yeah. Justin, with respect to the difficulty of proving damages in Canadian libel claims, that's a very, very different scenario than I think what people are used to when they're reading about American libel law, where not only can you be on the hook for whatever direct damages you cost? But people are saying, you know, well, there's emotional damages and my reputation itself. You know, it's not just this deal that fell through. How many deals might I have had in years to come that your defamation has cost me? And we read about these really gargantuan numbers of $50 million, $100 million rulings in Canada, even to get the court to agree to covering that specific supposed loss can be a struggle for plaintiffs.
Right. I mean, I'm not an expert in U.S. law, but you do see those kind of big numbers coming out of the U.S. And in a lot of cases, it's a function of having jury trials as well, which are kind of more common in the mm-hmm. U.S. than in Canada. In Canada, the general position of courts is that your what they call general damages for defamation are going to be relatively low, as I said. And if you want to go beyond that, you kind of have to fall into one of three categories. You either have to show a specific kind of loss, which the plaintiffs in this case satisfied the judge through that business deal,
mm-hmm.
or you have to show that the defendant has kind of engaged in the type of conduct that the court will award additional damages just to kind of denounce that conduct. Not to get too technical, there's two categories. There are aggravated damages, which goes to the defendant's conduct throughout the lawsuit. And here, for example, Mr. Johnson, even after being served with the claim, continued repeating the libelous mm-hmm. statements over and over again. The judgment even talks about accosting Mr. Fakih and his kids at the shopping mall and repeating some of the statements in front of his family.
Yeah, it's awful.
So he gets, you know, aggravated damages here as well. And finally, there's punitive damages, which the court awards kind of to denounce conduct that is disrespectful of the judicial process. And you referred earlier to the fact that he was evading service. They didn't show up to court appearances. They didn't respond to correspondence. They weren't participating in the process respectfully in the way that one would expect a defendant to do.
But there's another thing that the judge is very explicit about here. She says, it is important for us to assess the behavior of the Johnston defendants in its wider context. It is not an isolated example. Instead, it reflects an overall rise of hate speech in Canada. What seemed clear to me, Justin, is that there was an effort here to confront and make an example of Johnston as sort of embodying hate speech that cannot be tolerated. Is it fair in a libel ruling to hold Johnston responsible for the overall impact of hate speech writ large? I don't know if the damages are directly tied to that, but it's certainly suggested when she goes out of her way to talk about how hate speech is making this democracy toxic and can lead to genocide.
I didn't read that part of the decision quite the same way. I don't think it's appropriate in a defamation ruling to kind of make an example out of somebody to address wider societal trends. And I'm not sure I see the court as doing that here. I think what that section of the judgment does speak to, though, is the judge was clearly concerned about this type of conduct and the fact that it is on the rise. And I think rather than necessarily amplify the damages against Mr. Johnson on that basis, it is a message to other potential litigants and to future courts that they should be sensitive to these issues and they shouldn't be reticent to make a strong and appropriate remedy in the right case.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to do my best here to look at this from like a civil liberties point of view. Like, is there a slippery slope argument or a libel chill aspect to this, given just how indefensible the speech itself is? And, you know, he did not defend himself as a technical point. It's kind of hard to get there. Do you see any aspect? Like, is there any aspect where this is going to set a certain kind of like goalpost? I mean, this is, she goes on and on about hate speech. This isn't a hate speech case. There is a hate speech charge against him, but this is a libel charge.
It's difficult to articulate a real civil liberties concern when you have facts that are this egregious. And it's you know, it's almost a situation where, you know, if you tried to write, you know, a law school exam question that would be illustrating the value of the tort of defamation.
Flip to that page, yeah, and it's Kevin the Jackal.
A fact scenario like this would be a worthy contender. I feel very strongly about free expression issues and defend those issues as part of my day job. But when comments like this are made, you know, it's difficult to see it as anything other than the tort of defamation doing what it was designed to do.
Okay, so this is civil law, And yet everything about Kevin Johnston's behavior in the past gives us no reason to believe that he is going to be respectful of this ruling whatsoever. So it seems reasonable to expect him to continue to do that and to try to fuel his online fame and infamy and crowdfund based on this. What could happen to him if that's what he chooses to do?
There are two consequences that could follow. The less serious of the two is something called civil contempt, contempt of a court order. And that requires an order from the court that's clear and unequivocal in terms of what it requires. It requires the defendant to have notice of the order, and it requires the defendant to intentionally breach that order. And the consequences for civil contempt could be anything from a fine ranging to a jail sentence. The more serious consequence is criminal contempt of a court order, which requires breach of a court order in a public way that is designed to undermine the authority of the judicial system.
I fully expect him to do exactly that.
Well, in that case, it may be a matter that returns before the courts, and you know, the next installment of the saga may be contempt proceedings.
Hey, one thing that I wish we had caught and discussed with Amira. After Kevin Johnston's co-accused, Ron Banerjee, settled with Mohamed Faki and apologized to him, Faki donated $25,000 to the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, of which Amira is a board member. Hi, Amira.
Hey, Jesse.
Ramadan Mubarak.
Thank you. Thanks, Jesse.
Let me just get you to introduce yourself and tell me what you do.
All right. Hey there. I'm Amira Al-Gawabi, and I'm a human rights advocate. I'm the founding board member of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network.
Amira, your work involves tracking Islamophobia and hate speech in Canada. How did you first come to know the name Kevin Johnston?
Well, it was right around 2015. He was involved in what was his effort to stop a mosque being built or zoned for in Mississauga. He had created a website called Stop the Mosque, and he, you know, was getting a lot of attention. And I remember at the time I was working at a human rights advocacy organization, and we were really, you know, taken aback by how he was promoting, you know, hate against Muslims and really being very inflammatory, going after the mayor, Bonnie Crombie, for supporting the mosque. And so that's sort of the first time we started hearing about him. And frankly, at the time, we really didn't take him very seriously. He was, you know, he was kind of talking out of the side of his mouth. No one really wanted to take him seriously. But at the same time, recognizing that we couldn't really accept someone saying that. So, of course, we wrote statements. We criticized the way that he was talking about our communities. And certainly, Bonnie Crombie stood up pretty strongly against his type of rhetoric.
Let's hear a bit of that rhetoric now.
I am running for mayor in the city of Mississauga. Yeah! And when I win the mayor's seat, the first thing I do is I take the Peel Regional Police with me to Ikra Khalid's constituency office, and we arrest her for treason!
Yes, sir!
What did you make of this guy? Was this the first time you'd heard this kind of stuff? Were you able to kind of, like, what's his deal?
Yeah, I mean, we, of course, we'd unfortunately had seen Islamophobia in Canada before him. You know, he's certainly not a pioneer in that regard. But at the same time, you know, it was getting a little bit alarming, especially when in 2016, and this is sort of when he kind of made those national headlines, he said that he would offer $1,000, actually this was 2017, $1,000 for videos of Muslim children praying in Peel Region schools. That's really when he started getting more attention, which is exactly what he was after. You know, he, in one of his commentaries, said, what we want is for the CBC and you know, all the mainstream newspapers and news to be talking about Muslims and how dangerous they are. And really, that was a sense of how he really was threatening the well-being of our communities.
He's like putting a bounty on the privacy of Muslim girls.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, people, I think, went to at least one public school to protest against the accommodation of students who wanted to pray. You know, one school in Peel had to call in the police, you know, had to ensure that there was security around it. And as you can imagine, that's really traumatizing for not just Muslim kids, but all kids at a school to know that there's, you know, this kind of activity going on and that they are in potential threat. All of this is before the Quebec City Mosque massacre, which has actually sort of now amplified the real risk of this type of vitriol. And so I think that now everyone is also looking at this type of hate through that lens. And I think finally, people are really understanding that this is not just some person spewing off and, okay, well, let's just, you know, just ignore him. No, these types of people, and he has actually called for violence. He's called for people to shoot Iqra Khalid, an MP who brought forward the motion M103 in Parliament, as you remember. He's suggested that people should be violent when they see a Muslim. Like, he is someone who is promoting hate. And in fact, he was charged with a hate crime a few years back, and that's still going through the courts of promoting hate. So this is a, you know, this is a dangerous individual.
Currently, it seems that he has 5 supporters and $19 US a month through his Patreon. I think it's fair to say that this was a fairly unpopular bigot. And to describe, you know, we played some audio for people to get a sense of what he sounds like. I guess he tries to cut a figure of sort of a puckish. He looks kind of like a, you're not trying to take any slights, just be descriptive, like a chubby Jack Nicholson, kind of like he has these sort of rose-colored sunglasses and the spiky gray hair and arched eyebrows, and he's dimpled, and he's kind of like chasing people down to their car and asking them the tough questions and shooting insults at people. In terms of his philosophy, I think it seems he's coming from a Islam is trying to take over the world, Sharia law in Canada, what's next? You know, Justin Trudeau is in league with, it seems like kind of just like the greatest hits of Islamophobia, I suppose. Like
Right, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, so he calls himself Kevin J. Johnston, and the J is for jackal, right? So it's like, you know, what is he trying to create? He's trying to create this caricature, almost, you know, of this guy who, you know, is going to cut through all the sort of political correctness, and he's going to tell everybody what, you know, what Muslims are really up to. And as you said, it is like the absolute worst of the worst Islamophobia you can imagine, you know, that every Muslim is a potential danger, that they, you know, he is among the vanguard who are going to protect Canadian quote-unquote values. I was reading somewhere something that he wrote or said about, you know, it's not that he's racist, but he just wants us all to sort of rally around the Canadian flag and you know, baseball and this sort of thing. And when it comes to Islam, you know, that's just antithetical to that vision of Canada that he, you know, kind of hold somewhere in his distorted view of the world.
It's, I think, fair to place him within this modern iteration. You know, you think about people who hang outside of mosques yelling slurs at people, and you think of just rather disgusting and unpresentable people. I think he's trying to be a part of this modern media movement of, he's there with the camera, he's presenting himself, he's trying to kind of score points, and the MO is YouTube channel, crowdfunding, and also networking, and he's associated with other racist Islamophobes, including Ron Banerjee, who is his co-accused in this libel case that we're going to talk about. Can you give me a little bit of context on Ron Banerjee?
Right. So Ron Banerjee, he is another sort of, you know, fellow traveler in the world of anti-Muslim hate. He sort of founded a group called the Canadian Hindu Advocacy. He's very involved in another group called Rise Canada. And he sort of came to prominence in his loud and offensive opposition to the idea of, again, Muslim students being allowed to pray in public schools. So a few years back, it was a real huge controversy in Toronto with the Toronto District School Board. And he was, you know, trying to mobilize people in opposition to this. He would organize, you know, these protests. And at one point, you know, it seemed that he had, a little bit of a following and some support. But over the years, you know, it's really quite dwindled. And he also, similar to Kevin J. Johnston, is trying to carve out this niche for himself. You know, I think they're bigger in their minds than they are in the overall far-right movement.
And the kind of ideological underpinning for Ron Banerjee, if Kevin J. Johnston is sort of trying to advocate for white Christian Canadians, Ron Banerjee, it seems like there's some Hindu nationalist ideology that he's operating from.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was interesting because just a week ago, I think there was a rally organized by Pegida and Rise Canada. Soldiers of Odin were there. And Ron Banerjee was there with his video camera taking video. And, you know, someone was saying, hey, Ron, you're going to convert everybody to Hinduism. And he's like, sure I am, you know. And it was really quite odd. So he's coming from a different direction. But, you know, all of this, these types of, I guess, ideologies kind of coalesce around a central theme. And again, it all boils down to we hate Muslims and we're going to make their life as miserable as we can.
Yeah. Strange bedfellows where you've got Ron Banerjee as a brown-skinned person associating with Soldiers of Odin and other people who are very closely associated with white nationalism, white supremacy, if not outright white racists, kind of willing to kind of form common cause. Let's hear a little bit of Ron Banerjee's rhetoric.
No Islam allowed in Canada. No Islam in Canada. Islam is violence. Islam is evil. Islam is rape. Rape. Islam is rape. Islam is nothing but a rape cult.
Okay, that's enough of that. Yep. This is the most virulent, disgusting. I mean, he's made comments. Muhammad was a pedophile and a child molester. He's called for a ban on Islamic immigration, ban Islam itself. I think this is sort of the lowest of the low and the most, I mean, clearly reprehensible targeting of a people.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's no doubt about it. And anyone who's, you know, talks about free speech, I mean, you have a really messed up view of what free speech is if you think that that's okay.
He has made videos with Kevin Jackal Johnston, and one of those videos is at the core of this landmark libel case. I want to go through that. Who is Muhammad Faqih? So how did he become a target to Kevin Johnston and Ron Banerjee?
So it all goes back to 2017. Muhammad Faqih, who was organizing a fundraiser, a liberal fundraiser at his Mississauga location, found, you know, that there were some people outside of the gate and they were filming. He didn't really know who they were, didn't know what was going on, you know, would later say that he knew that they were kind of protesting. He was talking to his chef to say, let's prepare them some food and let's send it out, you know, thinking, you know, let's just neutralize this. Let's not really anticipating what would eventually occur. And meanwhile, who was it? It was Kevin Johnston and it was Ron Banerjee. And they were there, they were filming, they were making all sorts of horrific statements, all under the guise of, you know, protesting the $10 million settlement that Omar Khadr had just received from the federal government. But it all became all about Muhammad Faqih. And they started, insulting, making very defamatory Islamophobic comments outside of the event, harassing people who are coming to attend it, saying, you know, you can't get, you know, you can't, basically you can't get in there if you're not a rapist. You know, this is a jihadist, this is a terrorist. And essentially they filmed all of this and they would create about 8 videos that would later be posted online. And that is at the center of the defamation suit that Muhammad Faqih would later launch a month later against the both of them.
The libelous material, and why I think this was a case for a libel case and not simply a hate speech case, it has to do with the specific things they were saying in that video, including what you just cited, but also suggesting that Muhammad Faqih was paid by Pakistani's intelligence agency, that he was a terrorist sympathizer, that the reason why this restaurant was in an industrial area was because they were hiding something at some covert terrorist operation. Now we're moving into the libelous material where accusations are being hurled. And I want to clear up, often with the conspiratorial minded people, there's some kernel of something that they're basing their accusations and their claims on. Did they have any prior problem with Muhammad Faqih, or was there any kind of like substantiation, whether fraudulent or otherwise, that they're basing those claims on? Or was this just like a litany of, were they just free associating? Was this a jam session of Islamophobic hatred? Or are you aware of any kind of complicated conspiracy theory that they have in mind here?
All we can tell really is that it was really about realizing that the Prime Minister, Liberal members of Parliament were going to be at this fundraiser, I guess connecting the Liberals with the Muslims. And you know, there's a lot of conspiracies about Liberals being Islamists themselves, uh-huh, supporting M103, supporting immigration from various countries, supporting Syrian refugees.
I see. So it's a confirmation bias thing. For all we know, he was just sort of spewing and making up this stuff, literally making up these associations and these accusations on the spot. but then it kind of becomes real, or perhaps cynically he just thinks, well, this is a target worth pursuing. And it might have been Justin Trudeau that led Johnston and Banerjee to Paramount Fine Foods in the first place. But then Johnston just continues this campaign against Faqih.
Absolutely. You know, and again, I think it's important to point out that, you know, Mohamed Faqih is not the first person that Kevin Johnston went after. You know, I was actually in Peel a few years prior to that when he was making videos about the students who were trying to stand up for their right to pray, and, you know, and that there was this big protest there as well in Peel, in District School Board. And he was making videos about, you know, at least one of the young women who was trying to articulate why it was important to have those spaces. And that one of that video, you know, it had an image of her, you know, again, with blood splattered behind the image, you know, and those types of videos were being made about regular folks. Complaints were made to the police that, you know, this is promoting violence against these individuals. Bonnie Crombie herself was targeted by Kevin Johnston. He used to have, you know, this online kind of newsletter, and he wrote that Bonnie Crombie was involved in supporting an Islamist takeover of high schools, and that somehow she was doing that to, I don't know, protect her son who is gay. It was just this weird logic that didn't actually make any sense at all. And she actually made a complaint to the police about how he was promoting hate against her. So there's a pattern here. And I think that basically what happened is Kevin Johnston messed with the wrong person, you know. And it kind of highlights, you know, Mohamed Faqih was able to sue both of them, Ron Banerjee and Kevin Johnston, because he has the means to do that. There's a lot of other folks that he's gone after that didn't necessarily have the means.
We're sort of testing the edges of whether you can just sort of say anything. And, you know, this ruling is perhaps the strongest indication from the courts of, like, no, there are lines and there are costs if you step over. But that is a remedy only available to people with means. Regardless, this was, I think, one of the most substantiated libel claims I've ever read. One thing about facing a libel charge is that there's a pretty easy escape hatch. If you apologize, it really mitigates what can happen to you afterwards. And Ron Banerjee, who we heard earlier screaming about how Islam is a cult of rape, took the easy way out and simply apologized. Let's hear what that sounded like in contrast with how forcefully and passionately he was screaming at that mosque. Let's hear him apologize to Mohamed Faqih.
I said that in order to be permitted entry into the Paramount Fine Foods restaurant, you got to be a jihadist. I also said you need credentials. You have to have raped your wife at least a few times to be allowed in there. I either agreed with Mr. Johnston's statements or made no attempt to correct them. These statements were entirely without merit, and I provide this unqualified apology. I hope everyone seeing or reading this apology learns from my mistake.
Well, that's kind of delicious to hear. I mean, even though he's clearly, you know, as if with a pistol to his head, but
right.
I don't have a problem with that, you know.
Right, absolutely. And you know, it was interesting because when they lost that initial counter challenge, that's when Ron, you know, asked, I want to take a settlement. Part of the settlement, some of it we don't know, part of it was this apology. And when the apology was shared online, it was shared far and wide. It was really important that people saw, you know, this man apologize. It was very important for Mohamed Faqih himself. He wrote later that he showed that video to his children. It's really been important to demonstrate that in Canada, we do have protections against, you know, the promotion of hate against individuals and defamation and libel.
Which brings us to Johnston, who did not videotape an apology like that, though I think that the option was probably available to him. Instead, and this is what's really interesting to me, instead it seems, well, the court has ruled that he treated the entire legal process with utter disdain. He evaded attempts to even be served with papers. He wouldn't produce documentation that the courts were demanding of him. What I want to talk about with you is, as somebody who monitors online speech, you kind of have these personalities who operate outside of their usual rules. The usual rules of reason, the rules of journalism, where you would have to substantiate your claims, give the other side a chance to speak. And in this case, outside of the rules of law. Johnston thumbed his nose at the process. And in a sense, there is a bubble that is created around these personalities where the more they're able to define themselves as jackals, as rebels, and fuel their online personas, they can kind of create a reality for themselves where you're only making them stronger by anything you throw at them. Ultimately, reality seems to have caught up with Kevin J. Johnston. And I'm wondering if that's accurate or if his version of reality, where all the persecution just fuels his fame, is in play. Like, is that actually coming true for him?
Well, I think it's still early to tell. He's certainly trying his best. You know, in preparation for this interview, I was sadly having to watch some of the videos that he has with sort of other figures who are also self-styled Islamophobes, anti-establishment, all that sort of thing. So he's certainly trying to get some fuel out of this. He's trying to fundraise to appeal this judgment. He's definitely trying to build himself up as that persona. And that, I think, what he's been trying to do all along. You know, I think we should mention, of course, that he actually ran for mayor twice, once in 2014, once last year. In 2014, he got 700 votes. But last year, he got over 16,000 votes. So
for mayor of Mississauga.
For mayor of Mississauga, votes. Absolutely.
You know, we talked so much about Faith Goldie's campaign in Toronto, but 16,000 votes in Mississauga, I did not know that.
That's right. And that was while he had a hate crime charge against him. So people definitely knew that, you know, something was off with him.
Amira, the ruling was clear that I think the court did want to make an example out of him. That this was the courts stepping in saying, you know what, there are limits to what you could say online. And there is no indication that Kevin J. Johnston is going to heed the court's orders. I doubt very much he has $2.5 million. He's back on YouTube. I think this guy wants to go to prison, and I think he wants to make himself a martyr. And I think that might work. If he's, I don't know, would he be the first Canadian to serve prison time for something he said on YouTube? If he earns that distinction, it's possible that he will elevate himself to some level of martyrdom amongst this racist community. Do you feel like the court's ruling might backfire?
Well, I mean, when you put it like that, it definitely is worrisome. You know, no one wants to see these types of people held up as heroes. But that being said, no, I think this ruling was a very important message. I think it signaled to everyone who's worried about the rise of the far right, the rise of online hate. You know, there's a lot of discussion about these issues right now, and there's a lot of consternation about how to handle it. So the court, I think, has restored some confidence that people will be held to account for promoting hate online. You know, I could not say that with any great certainty before this ruling. I really had a lot of doubt about that. I remember sitting with the chief of police of Peel and some of the senior officers there, and frankly, they were not really sure how to deal with him and his online videos. So I think this is a very important step forward. I'd like to see our criminal justice system catch up as well and send similarly strong consequences and messages to those who are purveyors of hate. And I think that it's sends a very important message to targeted communities that they will get their day in courts, especially if they have enough money to go to court. And that means that I think that the government also needs to look at how we address all of the issues that have come out of this particular case.
That is your Canada Land episode. Please email me about it. I read everything you send me when you send it to jesse@canadalandshow.com. We are on Twitter @CanadaLand, and our website is canadalandshow.com. There's a new episode of Oppo out this week. Listen to a little taste of Oppo after these credits to get a sense of why Oppo is the number one Canadian politics podcast in this whole country. There's an election coming up, and this show will keep you informed. This episode is produced by Kasia Mihailovic. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. We do all of this because of crowdfunded support. We rely on it. If you want to help us, please visit us at patreon.com/CanadaLand and have a look at all the stuff that we want to give you as a sign of appreciation, including ad-free versions of our podcasts. Again, it's patreon.com/CanadaLand. We'll be right back.
Jen, there's an election coming up in the fall, and you may have noticed that Canadian politics has gotten a little bit bonkers recently. I mean, there's the SNC-Lavalin affair, Nazis are back now, I guess.
There's Jason Kenney's civil war, Doug Ford is blowing up Ontario, and apparently PEI is now powered by fish. The point is, so much crazy shit is happening right now that it can be hard to keep up. That's why we're here.
As the election looms, our podcast OPPA will keep you informed about the week in Canadian politics. Along the way, we're going to be speaking to Canada's top politicians, a whole bunch of the bottom ones, and everybody in between.
So listen to OPPA for all the twists and turns as the election comes.
That is OPPO, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts.